We'll hear argument on number 95, 1598, Leroy Young versus Ernest Eugene Harper. Ms. Howard.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. During the past decade, Oklahoma, like many other states, has experienced a serious prison overcrowding problem. In an attempt to deal with this crisis and at the same time to meet the goals of incarceration, the Oklahoma legislature has had to come up with some innovative programs. One such program is the program at issue here today, the pre-parole conditional supervision program. Ernest Harper was placed on this program after serving 14 years of a life sentence for first-degree murder. He was reclassified to a higher security level when the governor of Oklahoma denied his parole. The Tenth Circuit found that because Mr. Harper had been serving his sentence outside the physical boundaries of a prison, that his program was like parole and that he was entitled to the full protections of a Morrissey versus Brewer hearing before reclassification. We believe the Tenth Circuit erred in one major reason. The Tenth Circuit failed to consider the true nature of the program. The Tenth Circuit's approach to the program was really very simple. The Tenth Circuit found that because this was a program in which a prisoner was serving his sentence outside the four walls of the prison, that it was like parole. It is really very different from parole in several respects. First, I think what we need to do is look at the nature of the program. You told us that in Sandin, and you had told us that previously in Meacham versus Fano and other cases. And when we look at the nature of the program, we have to consider several things. First, we have to consider the purpose for which the program was instituted. We have to consider the function of the program, how it operates within the state. And this program, unlike parole, does not function as a program to reintegrate people into society. It functions as a program to alleviate prison overcrowding.
Ms. Howard, did the state have any procedures in effect at the time this case arose for a situation like this where one group permitted the pre-parole, but then the governor subsequently denied parole? Were there any written procedures in place for that situation when this case occurred?
There were some written procedures at that time. They did not deal specifically for reclassifying somebody in the particular situation that Mr. Harper was in.
So the answer is there wasn't anything that covered this case.
Nothing specific.
And subsequently, the state has adopted some procedures?
Several procedures have been adopted by our Pardon and Parole Board since that time. In 1991, after the time Mr. Harper was already brought back onto the program, our Pardon and Parole Board adopted a policy where they now leave people out for 90 days before reexamining them and determining whether to bring them back.
And then it's discretionary with the board whether to terminate it, the pre-parole, simply because the governor had denied parole?
Actually, it's a determination made by our Department of Corrections, which is somewhat confusing in this case. The Pardon and Parole Board recommends people for pre-parole to our Department of Corrections, and the Department of Corrections makes the ultimate decision about it.
And on what basis do they now make that decision? Is it just totally discretionary
with
the department, or do they consider how the prisoner has behaved on pre-parole?
It is totally discretionary with the department, and they derive their authority from this court's opinion in Meacham versus Fine.
Well, can they flip a coin?
Yes, they can.
Under Oklahoma law, you would advise the board that they can flip a coin?
I would advise that that would be permissible in this situation.
You then take it that the claim before us today doesn't carry a substantive component to it.
No.
That you go through the motions of a hearing, but then they can flip a coin.
Well, I'm not.
And that gives them due process.
Right.
Is that
right? Well, I'm not discounting any type of claim, a First Amendment violation or an Eighth Amendment violation. If there were an independent constitutional violation, we're not saying that they could revoke on the basis of exercising their First Amendment or, you know, on the basis of race. But other than that, other than some independent constitutional violation.
What was it in the regulations or the statute at the time that this took place that said that pre-parole can be revoked upon the governor's refusing a pardon?
Again, there's nothing specific in the statute. What we do have, we have a statute which implements the program, and it indicates that people on that program are inmates within the Department of Corrections. It indicates that they are subject to escape charges if they don't report back from the program. It indicates also that they're subject to the disciplinary proceedings of the Department of Corrections. From that, we assume, or we know, that this is a type of classification within the Department of Corrections under Meacham versus Fano.
But Mr. Harper was asked at the time he was put in this program He was asked to sign a form, and I'm looking at page 5 of the joint appendix.
Yes,
sir. And that form says, reviewed options available in the event of parole denial. And he signs it, and I guess somebody from the Department of Correction signs it. Well, what were those options that were reviewed with him that would be available in the event of parole denial?
Again, we don't have anything specific in our regulations saying what those options were. I am told by the Department of Corrections that at that time it was automatic, that if the governor denied parole, they automatically reclassified to a
high security. So that this was a misrepresentation on the form that they asked him to sign? It said options.
Well, we don't know for sure if those options are only limited to two options of either being bought back in or being stayed out. It could be other options that are not directly related to the specific decision about whether to reclassify or not. You know,
was staying out, as you put it, one of the options?
At that time, it was not. It is now. At that time, it was not.
In fact, as I understand it, some of these individuals who were denied parole were brought back, like this particular prisoner, and some were not. Is that correct?
At the time,
not all of them have been brought back.
At the time that Mr. Harper was brought back, everyone in his similar situation was brought back in.
But that's not the case now.
That is not the case now.
You mean there were no options then?
Well, there were no options as far as if you consider the options stay out or come in.
What other options would there be?
Well, like you, I'm somewhat troubled by that language, but I think perhaps it could refer to other types of options once he's back within the prison, you know, which institution he's going to be placed at, whether he's going to be at a minimum security in the southern part of the state or in the northern part of the state, you know, other types of restrictions that may be placed on him.
What is the change in the law between the time he was brought back and the present that explains why some of the prisoners are not being brought back today, whereas he was?
Do you mean what is the rationale behind the change?
Well, has there been any change in the state statute?
There has been no change in the state statute with regard to that. There's been one slight change in the statute which deals with educational programs.
But that doesn't cover this.
Right.
What does explain, as a matter of law, if anything, the difference in treatment?
I don't know that there's anything as a matter of law.
So it's a matter of administrative practice?
It's a matter of administrative policy, which is really my point here, the point we're trying to make with this case.
Before you go on to that, how is the decision being made today as to whether a given prisoner will be brought back or not? I mean, I assume they're not flipping coins.
No.
But how are they making this decision?
A review board of the Department of Corrections is making the decision.
And what is it grounding its decision on? What does it consider?
Again, there are no specific statutory or regulatory guidelines, but they...
Wow. If it's not flipping a coin, wouldn't a hearing with an opportunity to appear and give reasons why one should be brought back or not brought back function as a normal due process hearing would function?
It might would function as that, but I think the question here is whether there's a liberty interest in this program such that he's required to have a hearing.
But in any case, leaving the liberty interest issue aside, there would be the same function for this hearing that there would be, I presume, for a parole revocation hearing. There would be an opportunity to argue that one should not be brought back for whatever equitable reasons one could raise. That's fair to say, is it?
There would be that argument, but again, under Meacham versus Fano, I keep coming back to, but that case discussed the fact that when you're dealing with classification systems like this one is, that there's no right to participate in the decision of whether or not to reclassify. It's purely
this is a question which involves not only is a reclassification, but a revocation of liberty. And Morrissey and Brewer says expressly, whatever you call it, by whatever name, the liberty, in fact, is an interest which deserves a hearing before it is revoked. So I don't see why you don't fall within the terms of Morrissey, because you have A, liberty, in fact, and B, a discretionary decision about whether to revoke it or not.
I think we have to look at the Morrissey versus Brewer opinion closely to determine whether we do really fall into Morrissey, and there are several...
Well, you fall within the language that I just referred to. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
I would agree with that, but I think we also, and the court talks about this in Morrissey, is you have to look at the function of the program.
Well, yeah, I suppose also Morrissey against Brewer may have decided to describe kind of a generic parole. It didn't purport to account for all the different variations in the different states. And I gather what you're saying is that the Oklahoma system, at least now and perhaps as it was when this respondent was dealt with by, was different from the ordinary system.
That's exactly the point I wanted to make, Your Honor, that when Morrissey talked about parole, Morrissey talked about the fact that parole had been around for 60 years. It was a well-established part of the penal system.
Well, suppose we decided here, at least a majority were to conclude that it is most closely analogous to parole, and therefore Morrissey is some, it's applicable in some respect. Do you think the system the state now has in place would suffice if the ultimate decision is arbitrarily decided?
The system that now, the state now has in place still does not entitle the inmate to a hearing. So, you know, if this court were to find that, a Morrissey...
The new system does not give the inmate a hearing.
No, it does not. It allows the inmate to stay out for a certain time before the Department of Corrections makes a decision to bring him back in. But the new system does not entitle him to a hearing.
And if this court thought that Morrissey were applicable, do you defend that system?
If this court thought
that... We thought that it was analogous to parole.
If you thought that it was like parole, such that Morrissey applied, then I think we would have a hard time defending that system.
Well, you can't, under our due process cases, say that we have a particular scheme here and it doesn't call for a hearing, and therefore that's the end of it. I mean, if the scheme calls for a determination of facts before a particular action can be taken, then due process may be implicated, even though there's no provision for a hearing in the state system.
I would agree with that, but first you have to find a liberty interest.
May I ask, you said this is different from parole, and you never quite explained why. Would you tell me from the standpoint of the person out of jail, what's the difference?
I will answer that question, and then I'd like to also make a couple of other comments. From the standpoint of someone out of jail like Mr. Harper, there are several differences. One, Mr. Harper is still bound by the prison disciplinary proceedings. So if he commits some sort of disciplinary violation while he's out on pre-parole, just something that would be a disciplinary misconduct in the prison, like in disrespect to his supervising parole officer or something, he can be charged with a disciplinary violation and earned credits can be taken away.
And you don't think that Morrissey, if he was disrespectful to his parole officer, could have been disciplined?
There's no provision for that. Under parole, you're either revoked or there are no provisions.
I see. So, there's discipline short of revocation.
Exactly. Another important, I think, a real important point to make is that prisoners on this pre-parole conditional supervision program are earned credits within our Department of Corrections. Some states call them good time credits. We have a system where you're placed on a certain level and you may earn an additional 44 days or 33 days or 22 days based on things like the management of your living space, hygiene, participation in an education program or a job.
These are good time credits shortening the release.
Right.
Well, can't a person on parole earn those?
No. People on parole do not earn those.
Although I would take it, correct me if I'm wrong, but a parolee is subject to a certain amount of increased restrictions if he seems to be not quite adjusting to the instructions of the parole officer. They say you have to report to me three times a week instead of once a week. You must be home at night. You can't go out at night. So there are, it seems to me, all sorts of options that the parole officer has short of revocation.
There may be additional options depending
so then,
on...
So then that distinction between your pre-parolee respondent here and the parolee in the standard parole case doesn't seem to hold up in your answer to Justice Stevens.
Well, the distinction, I believe, is the fact that the things that I were mentioning to Justice Stevens show that this inmate, people on pre-parole, are continuing to serve their sentence under the Department of Corrections. With a parole program, yes, the parole officer could put additional burdens on a parolee if it was within the rules and conditions which were originally imposed upon him. They couldn't go outside those rules and conditions. But if they were within those rules and conditions, they could put additional burdens on them, but not the type of burdens that would be given to an inmate in a prison, which is what people on pre-parole have.
Ms. Howard, who administers the pre-parole program? Is it administered by the prison warden?
It's administered by our Department of Corrections.
Where, and who administers parole? Is it a separate organization?
It's the Pardon and Parole Board recommends people for parole, and they ultimately do administer that.
Yeah, but once they go out on parole, I mean, who takes care of seeing that everybody's abiding by his parole restrictions and so forth?
Parole officers would report that to the Pardon and Parole Board.
Okay, so the Pardon and Parole Board, which is independent of the Bureau of Corrections?
Yes. There are some overlaps. Like in this situation, people on pre-parole, they're supervised by parole officers, and they're employees of the Department of Corrections. So there's some overlap between the two departments.
So the supervisor, but while he's at liberty, would be the same whether he's on parole or pre-parole?
The specific employee might be the same. They're both parole officers. But that's just an ease of function with our Department of Corrections, is that they use these parole officers for performing these functions. But they still report to the Department of Corrections as opposed to the Pardon and Parole Board.
But the judgment whether to bring them back, for example, or whether to impose some kind of a sanction, whether it's more frequent consultation with a parole officer or denial of good time credits or whatever else, that judgment is made by the warden or by the Department of Corrections?
The Department of Corrections, yes, Your Honor.
Not by the parole board?
No. All they do is recommend people for placement on the program.
I still am not quite clear on the reasons that this respondent could have been brought back under the regulations and enforced. Page 18 and 19 of your brief, bottom of page 18, you said an inmate on the program is aware that he may be reclassified to a higher security level, I assume that means being brought back into the facility, for any reason, including that the governor denied the inmate parole, that he no longer meets eligibility requirements, or that he violated a rule. It seems to me that means that there must be some reason given. If you said for any reason at all, including flipping a coin, you wouldn't need those three classifications.
That gets us to the point that this court recently made in Sandin, which is that you don't look at language like that and pick it apart in a mechanical manner. You look to the nature of the program. And here, yes, there is some language saying you will be removed or you may be removed if you don't abide with the educational rules.
It says two things. You may be removed, which indicates there's some discretion, for a reason.
But that doesn't leave an implication that you may not be removed for any other reason. And that's exactly what this court was talking about most recently.
Well, then I don't know why you describe the program in that way. It seems to me your description is completely unnecessary if no reason at all is necessary to be given.
We're describing the program as a reclassification system. The inmate goes on the program, he signs the forms, the orientation that he signed, Joint Appendix, page 4, specifically on page 6, the inmate knew that he was being classified at a community level. That is a type of classification.
I don't have the Joint Appendix before me, Ms. Howard, but what exactly, you say the inmate was aware he can be reclassified or in fact brought back for several, including the governor has denied the inmate parole. Now, what exactly does that section you're referring to say about being brought back if the governor denies parole?
Again, I will admit to you, there's no specific language I can point to that says...
Is there general language you can...
General language that he's on a community level, general language that this case fits within Meacham versus Fano, which deals with reclassification.
Yeah, but now Beth's drawing a legal conclusion. But I'm curious to know just what's there.
We also have a statute, Title 57, Section 512, which says that the prison officials may transfer between institutions.
So the prison officials, in effect, regarded this as just another form of confinement.
Exactly.
Except it wasn't in the prison.
Well, the restrictions that were placed on the inmate were such that it is a type of confinement. With parole, as I was saying earlier, parole is an established part of the penal system. The purpose of it, everyone knew in Morrissey versus Brewer that the purpose of parole was to reintegrate people into society. Here, this program was implemented for overcrowding. It was implemented not because it was an integral part of any penological system, but implemented for a specific purpose.
What restrictions were placed on him that were different from restrictions placed on parolees?
As I was mentioning earlier, if he escapes, then he's subject to escape charges, criminal charges for escape. That's different than parolee. He's subject to the disciplinary proceedings of the Department of Corrections, different from parolee. If he needs medical treatment and wishes to have it paid for, he can go back into an institution and have that medical treatment. That's different from a parolee. Also, earning the credits and getting not only the time that he's out serving his sentence, but also additional time for credits. With parole in Oklahoma, a parolee gets credit for time that he's out on parole, credited toward his sentence, just flat time. But if a parolee's sentence is revoked and he's brought back in, he may or may not get credit for that time that he's been out serving. So if a parolee, say, has a 10-year sentence, and after 8 he's out and he has a 2-year suspended sentence.
May I ask this? Maybe it's the same question the Chief just asked in another way. There are a lot of reasons for it, and a lot of, if he does something wrong, different things can happen to him from a parolee. But supposing he just works and earns his money and pays his rent and does everything else and reports to whoever it is he has to report to. Does he, in his normal daily life, if he behaves himself completely, is there any difference in his life and that of a parolee?
If you're talking about day-to-day functions like, you know, visiting with his family and, you know, going on about...
Going to work and going to the movies or whatever it is.
And I can't think of anything specific in a day-to-day other than...
But he couldn't
leave
the state, isn't he?
The medical, I wanted to make a point about if he needs medical treatment, he has to go back in for it. He can't leave the state.
What is a parolee? Couldn't a parolee go back in for medical treatment?
Not unless his parole were revoked. I mean, the department...
Not unless his parole is revoked.
Yeah, if he wants to be willing to have his parole revoked, I suppose he could.
Can he leave the state?
He cannot leave the state.
So he's better off.
A parolee can leave the state with permission. Someone on the pre-parole program cannot even leave the state with permission. They can only leave the county with permission. So there are several ways.
On the medical point you made, I think you're saying that the person on pre-parole is better off than the parolee, right? If he has an option, the parolee doesn't have.
There are certain things about the program, if you just look at one isolated portion like that, that make it appear to be better. But overall, when you look at the true nature
because
of the
program...
If
he could pay for the doctor himself, he could go to his own doctor, just like the parolee could.
Right.
Well, of course, in that sense, all of the people still in prison are better off than the parolee.
Exactly. Better off than many of us on some occasions.
Well, he is confined to the county, and the parolee is confined to the state.
A parolee is technically released from his sentence of imprisonment. His sentence is suspended while he's on parole, and a person on the pre-parole program is continuing to serve his sentence.
Yeah, you want to answer my question? The parolee is confined to the state. Is that right?
I don't know that
unless he gets permission.
That he's, physically confined to the state.
Yes.
I'm sorry,
yes.
I misunderstood your question.
Yes, yes.
Yes, he is.
And the pre-parolee is confined to the county.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty big difference, I suppose.
How many people, in your estimation, how long, in your estimation, do people spend on pre-parole release?
Well, because of the nature of the program, I'd say about a year, generally, if they continue on the program, because pre-parole is considered a year earlier than parole is considered.
Are there people who were released for a year before their consideration of parole, and then parole was denied, who have remained out?
There may be people like that now. There were no people at the time Mr. Harper was brought back in, but now there may be such people, yes.
And how many people would you say approximately are on this program?
About, at this time, I would say about 1,200 or so are probably on the program. Again, there's nothing specific in the record dealing with that.
Does the parole board consider different factors in determining whether a particular prisoner should get pre-parole, such as whether he will be a threat if put on pre-parole to society and his chances of meeting the requirements and so forth? Do they consider that?
Again, I hate to keep saying this, but there's nothing in our statute which sets forth what considerations the parole board should make.
Is there anything in the statute about what they consider for parole?
Certain people are...
Anything in the statute?
Not specifically, no.
And do we have any reason to know whether they consider the same or different factors?
I think one reason that we would know that is that with pre-parole, we look at the purpose of the program, which is to alleviate overcrowding.
So even if it's a triple axe murder, you'd automatically give them pre-parole?
Not automatically, but they may be given pre-parole.
They wouldn't consider, you think, whether they're going to be a threat on release?
They certainly may consider that, but they are not required to consider that.
May I ask another question along just so counter's line? Supposing the prison is extremely crowded, is it permissible for the parole board to take that fact into consideration in deciding whether to grant someone parole? It might not be right on the margin.
It might be permissible because there are no specific guidelines for when.
So overcrowding could play a role in either decision.
It possibly could, but with this program,
it's specifically the response to overcrowding.
It is the purpose of the program, and in doing that, they might have to consider who best to let out. If they know they're going to have to let out a certain number of people, then they might let out the people who are less of a dangerous society. But that doesn't mean that...
Everybody else is a quadruple axe murderer. They would presumably let out the triple axe murderer, right?
Right.
But would they do the
same... Or the double murderer, such as Mr. Harper.
Would they do the same thing in bringing people back? That is, suppose they now get some extra cells free. Do they now bring people back because they say, we don't need all these people out there anymore, we have some extra cells, and there are a few people who've done worse things than others, and we're going to bring them back?
I'm not aware of any situations where they've done that because, to this point, we've never had any extra cells. But I think, pursuant to our program, we could, if the Department of Corrections chose to do that. When it got to the point to where the prison was no longer crowded, they
could. But I thought that under the program currently, someone is kept in the program, even if they're denied parole, until there's a 90-day period when they decide what will be done with the person.
They may be left out for 90 days, and then still a determination is made whether to bring them back or not, but they're still not entitled to a hearing at that point.
In terms of what is told to a person who is entering such a program, we've already established that we don't know what options there were, but he was also asked, Harper was asked to sign another thing, and this is on page 9 of the Joint Appendix. He signs saying, I understand that waiving parole while on pre-parole status will result in reclassification to a higher security status. What does that mean, waiving parole?
A refusing to be considered or deciding not to be considered for parole.
Someone decide that they don't want to be considered for parole.
It gets back to the point that Justice Stevens was making earlier, that there are some situations where pre-parole is more advantageous, and because a defendant is earning credits while he's out on pre-parole in addition to flat time served, he may get out earlier on pre-parole.
But
than he would
says
get out
if he does
given
that,
parole.
If
that,
he waives parole, it says, while he's on pre-parole status, back he goes. It will result in reclassification.
That's to prevent the situation of an inmate trying to manipulate the system that way, staying out on pre-parole rather than being placed on parole, where society would have their interests filled by having him in a program where he's being rehabilitated into society.
This is telling him you must be considered for parole when your time comes up. Otherwise, you go right back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. One point I want to make, too, is that the inmate's understanding of what he will and won't get from the program is not the critical factor here. This court discussed that in Sandin. This court discussed it in Connecticut versus Dumschat. The court also discussed that in Yago, J-A-G-O, versus Van Curen. In Yago, they had told an inmate that he would get out on parole, and then later the Department of Corrections determined that no, they wouldn't let him out. And the court said that even though there was a mutually explicit understanding that he would get out, that that did not give him a liberty interest in the program. The same thing with the Connecticut versus Dumschat case. Also, as my time winds down, I want to make the point that the purpose of this program, it's a prison administrative program. It's to deal with problems that are inherent in the prison. And this court was very specific in Sandin that federal courts should stay out of the day-to-day management of prisons. We need to be able to have as much opportunity as we can with these programs in order to experiment and try different things. You know, used to we brought people back in automatically if parole was denied. Now we leave them out 90 days or maybe even a longer period of time. That is a function of the program, and the prison administrators are the proper ones to make that determination on what we need to do with these type of programs. I'd like to reserve my remaining time, which I don't have.
Which you don't have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Winter, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, in Morrissey versus Brewer, the court examined the nature of a parolee's interest in his continued liberty. The court defined parole as follows. The essence of parole is release from prison before completion of sentence on condition that the prisoner abide by certain rules during the balance of the sentence. The court decided that even though the parolee's liberty is only partial and conditional, nevertheless, it includes many of the core values of unconditional liberty.
Do you think the Morrissey opinion was intended to apply to every single program that a state might set up that under the name of parole, no matter what the conditions of it were?
No.
Then you really have to examine the Oklahoma program, don't you, to see what would be Morrissey's impact on it in terms of a due process hearing?
Yes, I agree. And what we are really saying is that in the state of Oklahoma, they have created two programs, two parole programs, both of which fall well within the parameters discussed in Morrissey. One of these programs they call parole, and the newer program they call the pre-parole conditional supervision program. The eligibility requirements are identical for the two programs, with the exception that a prisoner can qualify a little bit earlier for pre-parole than for parole.
And do you agree with the counsel for the state that pre-parole can be revoked for any reason or no reason at all? That pre-parole can be revoked, that the respondent can be told to report to correction for any reason or no reason at all? Do you agree with that?
No. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. We think that
I tried to find out from the opposing counsel, the counsel for the state of Oklahoma, the grounds upon which pre-parole could be revoked. And I thought the answer was any reason at all. You can flip a coin. The corrections board can say, I'm bored, we'll just revoke all these people, we don't want to read all these papers. Do you agree that that is proper description of the duties of the corrections board under this program, that they can revoke for no reason at all?
The statute doesn't say. That's the way the state is interpreting it. And
do you agree with that interpretation?
I don't know exactly what Your Honor is asking. It seems to me that under the regulations, they say that they are making a decision. If they're making a decision, that has certain due process implications.
Well, apart from due process, under state law, are there any principles that guide the Board of Corrections in determining to revoke pre-parole status?
This case was heard in state court. There was never any, that issue never came up because this is a very new claim of the state that they can revoke for any reason or no reason in state
court. Would you agree that the Board of Corrections can give no reason at all? Say, well, I'm bored today, I don't want to read these papers, I'm just going to revoke all the parole, I'm not going to go through this paperwork. Can he do that, the corrections officer?
Well, we're here to say that he can't do that. I don't know anything.
I'm talking about under state law.
The statute doesn't speak to this. The regulations don't say it can be revoked for any reason or no reason. The regulations, the only existing regulations that have ever been promulgated in the state, either by the Department of Corrections or by the Pardon and Parole Board, would suggest the opposite.
I think they would suggest the opposite, and I think the form is set forth at pages 4, 5, and 6 of the joint appendix indicates that he has a certain expectation, that's the word the form used, that he is expected to be in compliance with all of these rules, which
well,
would indicate to me that under the state's procedure, discretion has certain boundaries.
Under the form that Mr. Harper signed, at the time, the form that was in use at the time that he was let out, the last thing he's expected to sign off on after having been given all the rules and procedures is a statement, I understand that my being released into the community is dependent upon my compliance with all of these expectations. And so it seems to me clear that at the time that he was released, at least the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board understood that they couldn't do it for any reason or no reason.
Well, it doesn't mean that. It just means if you don't live up to the expectations, you will be pulled back. It doesn't mean you can't be for other reasons, necessarily.
Well,
you're sort of compelled to argue, aren't you? Don't you really have to answer yes to the question Justice Kennedy was asking? If this could be revoked for any reason whatever, what good would a hearing be? I mean, you usually have a hearing to find out whether a particular legal requirement was complied with or not. If there's no legal requirement, what possible good is the hearing?
It seems to me that
your client comes in and says, you know, you pulled me back, and say, yeah, we did. Why? He said, well, because we felt like it. What? The hearing would be utterly useless, wouldn't it?
It certainly would be useless. There would be no point at all if they could bring them back, if under the Constitution they could bring them back for any reason.
So
why reason.
Why on that very point? There's a state court finding here that the reason that your client was removed from the program was because he was not granted parole by the governor of Oklahoma. They found that, I guess, in Judge Lumpkin's opinion. As positive as the issue is the fact, he was not granted parole by the governor of Oklahoma.
He shouldn't even.
Right?
What do you think?
No,
that's what it says. I'm reading it on page 48 of the record. Is dispositive, maybe it's a different case or something. 48 of your opinion.
The court may be looking at the district, the U.S. District Court opinion.
I'm looking at page 48 of the appendix where it says Gary Lumpkin, the presiding, maybe it's a different case or a
white brief.
Yeah, the white brief. Maybe is this the district court? Well, my question is this. I read that and I thought that the reason we have a finding here, what I thought was it says Court of Criminal Appeals of Oklahoma, order denying application for writ of habeas corpus. It's in the petition for certiorari. And what it says when I read it, maybe I'm asking this because you can clarify it for me, is it says dispositive of the issue in petitioner's case is the fact he was not granted parole by the governor of Oklahoma. It is for this, not a disciplinary reason. He was removed from the program. I thought everybody agrees to that. Am I right? Is that right, or am I mixing it up, or what?
Looking at everything that the Court of Appeals says, they say that we believe that the procedure, that is, the procedure that says...
I'm not asking about procedure.
This is... Are you talking, when you say Court of Appeals, are you talking about the Tenth Circuit or the Court of Criminal Appeals that Justice Breyer
is talking? Court of Criminal Appeals?
Yes. What I'm trying to find out is isn't it, what seems to be true is that he's saying, this judge, that the reason that your client was removed from the program was because he was not granted parole by the governor.
Yes,
all
but
right,
it
now,
seems to...
If that's so, I don't think your client disputes that he was not granted parole.
That's
Am I right about that?
That's correct.
All right, so what is the basic rule? I thought due process law, it's so basic nobody ever says it. But you don't have to have a hearing under the Constitution or any other rule if there's nothing to have a hearing about. And if, in fact, he was removed because he wasn't given parole, and if that isn't in dispute, what would there possibly be in this case to have a hearing about?
I don't think that is what the Court of Criminal Appeals...
I know it isn't what they said. All I want to know is if the underlying facts are correct, that it is that he was removed, that there is a finding in this court, a state court, that the reason his PP, whatever it is, was revoked is because he wasn't given a parole.
Yes.
Yes.
That's correct.
All right. If that's correct and he doesn't dispute that, then what is there to have a hearing about? And if there is nothing to have a hearing about, where in the Constitution does it require a court or an agency or anyone to have a hearing when there is nothing to have a hearing about?
There's the purpose of having a hearing here is exactly the same as it is in Morrissey. That is here. The triggering event for a hearing, they say now, can be the governor refuses to grant parole.
It's not just they say, it's the Court of Criminal Appeals of Oklahoma that says.
That's fine. We won't quarrel with that. When the governor denies parole, under this framework, that becomes a triggering event for hearing.
But you say it becomes a triggering event. That suggests that there are other issues to be inquired into. Well, what if the rule in Oklahoma is simply, when the governor denies parole, you're recalled, period?
That would be a different case.
Well, but there isn't any intimation in the opinion of the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals that more factors somehow are involved.
But I think there is. The Court of Criminal Appeals said, and the Attorney General relies on it, they said that what this framework provides is that he may be brought back in, which means that a determination is being made.
You know, nobody says that parole revocation is a necessary, there might be other reasons why you might revoke a person's pre-parole. What I take it as you say, is the case here is that this would be a sufficient reason under Oklahoma law. You have a judge of Oklahoma suggesting in the paragraph that it is a sufficient reason under Oklahoma law. It's not true under Oklahoma law at that time that it was a sufficient reason to revoke his PPCS. What would we look to as a matter of Oklahoma law to establish that?
Why don't we assume that it is a sufficient reason, just as a parole violation is a sufficient reason? But the court doesn't stop with this. The court says you can't stop with a sufficient reason.
Well, what if the statute itself expressly said denial of parole subsequent to having been granted pre-parole status is sufficient in and of itself to be grounds for removal from that status? Suppose the statute said it just that way. Would you be here? Would you have a case?
I think that would be a different case.
The suggestion being made to you is it is the same case as when an Oklahoma court says that is what state law is. How do you have a case if you wouldn't have under a statute that said it expressly, when you have an Oklahoma court decision that's the Oklahoma law? I think that's the question.
Would you mind posing the question to me again?
Well, to add to that is, of course you might be entitled to a hearing if it were in dispute as to whether the governor had in fact or not revoked the parole. But there is no dispute
over that. Isn't there another factor everybody's overlooking? The Oklahoma procedure is spelled out on 41A of the appendix is that when the inmate is denied by parole by the governor, but their cases shall be reviewed by the parole board 90 days from denial to determine whether that statute will be continued, indicating that the denial is not, it may be a sufficient reason, but is not always a sufficient reason.
And that's true now, but that wasn't true then.
That's the new one.
The assertion that it wasn't true then is nothing but an assertion. There's absolutely nothing in the record, it seems to me. I don't see it in the Court of Criminal Appeals' opinion.
Document when the new rules came in. Well, let's see if we can get agreement on a basic proposition, that is, suppose Oklahoma law was, you're denied parole. The denial of parole by the governor means you go back, no ifs, ands, or buts. There wouldn't be any due process right.
I would agree.
So the question is that what we have in this case? You would agree that there's no need for a hearing if it follows like the night, the day the governor denies parole, you're required to go back.
I do have one caveat. It seems to me that there are circumstances in which you could have a problem, a substantive due process problem, in having automatic revocation for a reason that is utterly irrational when you're talking about a precious freedom.
The reason is the governor denies parole. The governor has the discretion to grant or deny parole. The governor denies parole. The rules are denial of parole, you go back to prison.
In a situation like this where it happens quickly, I think that makes it like a furlough problem and that there's no problem with that if the statute says that.
Well, the question is that what this statute says? Because the 90-day period didn't come in until later.
The record has so much evidence, including a dozen statements by the Attorney General in its briefs. It's a very, it's a late argument that the statute means anything other than that it is discretionary. There are literally a dozen times that the Attorney General has said it in its briefs to this court and the lower court. There are the documents that Mr. Harper himself signed saying that there were options in the event of parole and saying that his continuing out remained on his compliance with conditions. And finally, the only evidence in the record as to what the statute means, whether or not there's discretion, are regulations. A number of sets of regulations by the Pardon and Parole Board and a set of regulations by the Department of Corrections, which appears in the appendix to their cert petition.
That is an essential part of your case, though. You, in order to get to the due process procedural point, you have to establish that there was not an automatic revocation of pre-parole status if parole was denied. that that was not the rule.
Yes, that that was not the policy.
Does the record tell us whether there were, I think your opponent said there were something like 1,200 people in the program, and does the record tell us whether or not when other people had their parole denied, they were automatically taken off the program?
No, the record doesn't tell us that. At the time that he was in the prison, when he was let out of the prison, the record is completely silent.
And I suppose then the question is, who has the burden of establishing what the rule of law was?
Well, it seems to me that...
Your client was the plaintiff in the federal court. I would think he would have the burden.
Our client was pro se. He asked for an evidentiary hearing.
Does that change the burden because he was pro se?
I think it changes the burden that he asked for an evidentiary hearing in the Court of Criminal Appeals and in the federal courts. This is an issue that is...
Well, now, wait a minute. We're kind of sliding around several things here. I take it it's up to the Court of Criminal Appeals of Oklahoma to decide whether or not someone is pro se would change the burden of proof there. Are you saying that as a matter of federal law, a federal court must shift the burden of proof because a plaintiff is pro se?
I'm not sure that it's... I think that the pro se habeas plaintiff is entitled at some stage to a full and fair hearing.
Well, he's got a right to a full and fair hearing on disputed facts.
This is a fact that at the time was not disputed. If the state had come in and said to our client, which they did not, the reason we brought you back in is because it's mandatory. Everybody is being brought back in. He could have tried to controvert that. He could have answered that. Instead, they argued two things that were clearly not true. One, that he was in confinement, and that's what everyone's fire was directed at. Is he in confinement? Is he in prison? And two, they made an argument that was so palpably untrue that no one could accept it, namely that he became ineligible. That became a mantra that we sometimes heard, but we know from the statute that he does not become ineligible for parole, for pre-parole, once parole is denied.
Oh, isn't that argument the same as the argument that he had to go back? Once parole was denied, he had to go off of pre-parole.
I just did.
Now, you say it's so inherently incredible. Maybe. Why is it incredible that that would be the policy?
No, I don't think it's at all incredible. I'm only saying that the Attorney General of Oklahoma has contradicted that position many, many times in its briefs to this court and to the lower courts, and that it never asserted its automatic...
Indeed, if that were the law, they couldn't have adopted the 90-day procedure.
No, it became put in a bind in the Court of Appeals. In the Court of Appeals, they first asserted a person becomes ineligible.
You're talking about the Tenth Circuit?
No,
the Court of Criminal Appeals.
And the Court of Criminal Appeals said in an interim order, which is in the record, please show me I want to see the law. Where are the regulations that say they become ineligible? At which point the Attorney General produced 004-11, which says you get a review in 90 days, making it clear that it wasn't mandatory. That's what the Court of Criminal Appeals, the very issue it was interested in, and that is the document that the Attorney General gave it. And I don't think that the Court of Criminal Appeals found either that there was an unvarying practice at the time, because that factual question never arose in the Court of Appeals.
It simply
didn't arise.
Fine. I have another question. I'm assuming you're right that really the standard was vague, and there are all kinds of reasons for any non-arbitrary, non-discriminatory, non-protected reason they could revoke this. All right, on that theory, why is your client entitled to a hearing? To be quite specific, there are lots of things called intermediate punishments involving halfway houses, involving nights and weekends in prison, involving a whole host of experimental things. And what you've heard the state say is, you know, we're not going to experiment. If to experiment means that every time we change our mind about any person, we have to go through some tremendous procedural process. What is your response? Which of those halfway intermediate punishments, in your view, trigger the procedural protection? Which don't? How do you distinguish the one from the other?
I think it's not too... I'm sure there could be gray areas, but at this point I've seen nothing that's a seriously gray area. A halfway house, you're still in prison. You're in a state facility. You're not in your own home or in your own bed, and you're constantly
home under house arrest would be different.
That could be different.
The line they want to draw is a line which says, look to whether authorities have retained virtually total discretion to revoke it. Under those circumstances, the prisoner doesn't have an expectation of remaining free. Unlike parole, where you're releasing the prisoner, giving the prisoner an expectation of remaining free, but for certain specified circumstances. Now, that's their line. And so I'm asking you, what's your line?
That it's not just about expectations, it's being out of prison. And that once you cross the threshold of the prison door and you are told, get a life, get a job, go to work, pay your bills, have relations with other human beings, have friends and family, and come and go to the movies and to the grocery store, you know that you're not in prison. And when you know that you're not in prison, something very precious has happened, and it shouldn't be taken away without a hearing. That's what I would say. And I know when I'm in a halfway house that I'm still in prison. And it may be that when I am being electronically surveilled all day, I know that I am in prison. Because something of the essence of freedom is having a choice to obey the rules or not, instead of because every minute you're being electronically surveilled or surveilled by a guard. This is a man who knew that he wasn't in prison, and that's why he's entitled to a hearing. For that reason, and because the state retained the discretion to pick and choose, to send some people back to prison when the governor denied parole, and to let
but
others
I
stay out.
I thought you said the record simply didn't show on that point.
I think that the reason it doesn't show is because it's a newly developed theory of the case.
Well, but then you really don't have the factual basis to say the governor or the board retained discretion. If the record simply doesn't show what happened to other people whose parole was denied by the governor.
Well, Chief Justice, it seems to me that even if in 1990, when Ernest Harper was let out of prison, there was an unvarying practice of bringing people back to jail when parole was denied by the governor, that wouldn't necessarily show that there was a policy. The evidence that they think that they have discretion to do it is in the later enacted regulations, and it may be that they felt like bringing everybody back in last week, and this week they feel like leaving everybody out, but they've already said it's the toss of a coin, and it seems to me that that kind of reasoning shouldn't be determining the very precious right that's at stake in this case.
They said it could be, as far as the Constitution is concerned, because there's nothing to which due process right could attach, a due process procedural right. Do we know whether anyone else was exposed to this telephone call or whatever it was, so returned to the prison within 5 hours? How long did the situation persist before the 90-day procedure came?
That regulation came into being 5 months after he was returned to prison. In August, I believe.
May I ask you, there was a statutory change during that five-month period?
There was a statutory change as follows. There's been a couple misstatements of the record that I would like to clear up here, and I'm not sure of the significance of this.
Before you do, will you tell me what the statutory change was?
It's the one that says there's an identical provision for both parolees and pre-parolees, and I believe they were enacted at the same time, and that provision says, if you don't keep up with the educational and job requirements that we put on you as a condition, you will become ineligible for parole. And that is the only thing in
the
entire...
And does either the statute before or after that amendment make any reference to the governor's denial of parole as a reason for terminating pre-parole?
No, neither before nor after. One other thing.
But we do have this opinion of the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, is it?
Yes.
Which denied the respondent's writ of habeas at the state level, saying dispositive of the issue in petitioner's case is the fact that he was not granted parole by the governor. It is for this, not a disciplinary reason, he was removed from the pre-parole program. So do we interpret that as meaning that the criminal appeals court thought that not being granted parole was a valid and sufficient reason for revocation of pre-parole status, and that in this very case, that was the reason? I mean, it seems to me what the Oklahoma court is saying.
I believe that what they're saying is that it is They are...
What if we read it that way?
I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the question. I do not believe that what they're saying is you must be brought in. They did not understand it to mean that.
It's not the question.
They understood...
The court understood that dispositive
yes.
of the habeas petition in this very case is the fact that he was not granted eventually parole by the governor. And it was for that reason that his status was revoked, not for some disciplinary reason or some other reason.
I believe that I misspoke before.
What if we interpret that, not you, what if we, this court, thinks that that constitutes a valid explanation of what the state law was at the time of this revocation?
Then it seems to me that you should say that the state law denies due process and that people must have a hearing. Because if
a hearing to do what? Because I think, first, there's no dispute on the fact that it wasn't any disciplinary reason, right? You concede
yes.
that the only reason given
yes.
was that the governor denied parole. So there'd be no hearing to decide what was the reason. Everybody agrees that he didn't commit any disciplinary offense, he was a model pre-parolee, yes. and he was called back for one reason only, that parole was denied.
In parole, a person can admit that they have violated a condition of their release, and they're still entitled to a hearing because there's a second decision. The parole board is exercising discretion, and Morrissey says, and Gagnon says, and Black versus Romano, it's dictum, but it goes on at considerable length, says, once you're exercising, that's just the first step, did he violate parole? Because if they can say he violated but will leave him out, then you ought to have a chance to argue that you should be one of those people who...
Are you saying that as a result of this pre-release, pre-parole scheme, that the discretion the governor previously had, which I assume was unreviewable, is now in some sense subject to a due process requirement simply because he was on release before the governor made his discretionary decision? Is that your argument?
No, not at all, Justice Souter, because there's a huge difference between parole, refusal to grant someone parole and bringing them back into prison. But all these
I think the argument you're making is that this excerpt from the Court of Criminal Appeals only establishes that denial of parole is a permissible reason
yes.
for revoking pre-parole, not that it is an automatic and mandatory reason. That isn't established.
Yes.
And your point is that if it is only a permissible reason, he should have the opportunity to argue that in this case it shouldn't be permitted.
Exactly.
In support of that, you quote from page 41A of the opinion, the last paragraph, where it says the governor's, where it says, we believe such a procedure gives an inmate sufficient notice when he's placed in the program that he may be removed from it when the governor exercises his discretion.
Yes, exactly. I believe that the Criminal Court of Appeals understood it to be discretionary.
Thank you, Ms. Winter. The case is submitted.